Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and The Learning College. Today we're going to start a new book, which is actually a collection of articles from an old newsletter. This book is called Siege by James Mason, who is a radical from some decades ago. Today we're going to do, as I have a PDF that's about 529 pages, I'm going to do up to page 29, so it's not going to take too long. And in general, I'm going to try to limit these sessions to an hour max. Maybe I'll go an hour 15 sometimes, but generally under an hour. So let's dig in. This will be the introduction and that type of thing. And this, what has happened is he put out a newsletter, and I think he'll talk about this in the book. He put out a newsletter for maybe 6 years in about 1980, around then forward. And later someone came and collected them into a book, and it's been revised a couple of times, but I think we've got a good one here. So Siege by James Mason, an ironmarch.org publication, revision 1, 2015-06-02. So a couple years ago someone arranged it. Cover is a picture from Maidan in the Ukraine, you know, showing a burning building. Editing by Zeiger. Table of contents, and this is what we'll cover this time. Preface to the second edition is 1.1. That's how he has it. 1.1, 1.2. 1.2 is introduction, and 1.3 is publisher's note to the readership. And let's see here. And 2 is very long, and that will be, we'll get into, we'll do that part by part next time. So it has a total of about appendix starts on 10, 11, 12, 13, so 4 appendices. But in general, it's shorter articles that are grouped together. And we should see the reason for that, and the logic behind it. All right, anyway, skipping through the table of contents. 1.1, preface to the second edition. Siege has turned out from the beginning to have had a remarkable career. Born out of emergency in the summer of 1980, it pulled its own weight financially for the 6 years of its original run as a monthly newsletter, until I decided to end it in the summer of 1986. And again, that's still about 9-10 years before the internet is truly mainstream. That was the nuts and bolts part of it, running as a newsletter paying its own weight from 1980 to 1986. And that is important, unless one is so taken up by hobbyism that they are willing to pour their own money into a losing venture. I was not and am not. The interest must be out there. Otherwise, why would anyone bother? Naturally, your packaging must contain a certain minimum of professionalism, but beyond that, you really ought to be saying something worth saying, and preferably something that hasn't already been said. From the start, I felt that I had these criteria together by virtue of a long career already behind me in what is generically called the movement. End quote. In short, I felt I had seen all the mistakes that could happen and had heard or read all the garbage that could be spoken or written, at least as regards the subject matter that this movement claims to specialize in. I knew I could avoid all that at the very least. So that's his background. He has a long background in the movement before he publishes this newsletter. I want to stop here to say there's also another PDF version. Both of these are at archive.org. Put out by Solar General that has a lot of pictures. I'm using this or other one. I'm not really sure it's who it's by other than what I mentioned. Ironmarch.org. That does not have the pictures, but is somewhat easier to read. But if you want to see some pictures, Mason with Pierce and Mason with other people, you can look that up on archive.org. And I'll also put both links in the thread at VNN Forum, where everything we record is at vnnforum.com and ultimately at alexlinder.com. So he felt he'd done and seen everything that could happen, so he was, you know, qualified to speak about these things. And he goes on, 3 years after the termination of the Siege newsletter, S-I-E-G-E, capital letters, wherever it appears here, that is, in 1989, an energetic and idealistic young man approached me with the proposal of making Siege into a book. If I'd supply him with a complete set of the newsletters, some 72 issues, he'd edit them into a book and publish them at his own expense. I said, all right, that I'd help him any way I could, but I cautioned him that in 10 years' time, he could still have them piled in his closet or garage. That is the trouble with print publishing. He accepted the risk, and, well before 10 years were out, Siege was a sensation and a complete sellout. They tell me that copies of this first edition, when they can be found on the internet, are going for a cool $150 apiece. I'd have done well to sat on a couple of cartons of them at the time, but I'm not an investor, nor am I a mercenary. All of my freebies were likewise handed out freely to friends and associates. Then, by the mid-90s, the book Siege having first appeared in 1993, the letters began to come to me begging for a source for a copy of the book. My only answer was that, if I needed one for myself, I wouldn't know where to find it. And so it only intensified as the 90s gave way to a new millennium. So it has stood up until now, after another young and idealistic person has come forth to give us this second edition. Once again, I determined that the interest was either going to be present or it was not. Beyond mere interest, there was going to once again have to be the expertise as well as the wherewithal to make it a reality. Because things had not gotten any easier since the first edition had been undertaken. One of the reasons for the long time required to bring out that first edition was the difficulty in finding a printer who'd handle it. In light of the events of September 11th, 2001, that already tiny pool has just about evaporated completely. And yet, where there's a genuine will, there's usually a way. You're holding that in your hands. We felt at the time that we might be letting ourselves in for some hassle from the system due to the perhaps, quote, volatile content of Siege, and indeed, the one, quote, movement, unquote, attorney at the time suggested we supply him with a copy just in case. As it turns out, not only did the system go out of its way to ignore Siege, so did all but one of the so-called, quote, leaders within this selfsame, quote, movement. As might be considered my right, I ascribed it to jealousy. The young man had done a magnificent job with the book, blowing whatever might have been its next closest competitor right out of the water, and I, for myself, had from the very beginning chosen not to waste a single word on tripe. That was the winning combination. This same formula had always been there for anyone to use. Why no one used it before is taken up in the pages of Siege itself. One more reason why the book was generally banned by the movement. But never was I interested in convincing anyone else of my sincerity, much less was I interested in impressing anyone who was more or less of my own persuasion. First, to distill some real truth and then to package it for the consumption by some minds who might just make a difference with it was my only concern. And things over the course of the last two decades and more have tended to show that we've actually enjoyed some success in the goal. This new edition is little changed from the first. The new publisher is apparently convinced that the book holds up well enough after 20 years so as to be worth one more turn on the merry-go-round. As its author, I'm aware where the book has dated, and even though I'd retract not a word from it, I might add a few things. But that would constitute another work. I, too, am convinced that Siege remains cutting-edge enough even today and still contains enough movement history so as to be eminently worth reading. So here it is, and I must confess that I am most gratified by it. Now, after all this time, a fair question might be of this literary antique and oddity. Were we dealing in a bit of prophecy and also of I told you so at the time? And now, in the present, has it all become I told you so with little, if any, prophecy left to it? You'll have to be the judge of that. James Mason, Spring 2003 is when he wrote that. 1.2 Introduction. James Mason is an ardent National Socialist who has achieved underground infamy. Mason's revolutionary rhetoric is deemed so subversive and violent that it has even alienated other Nazis. Siege shares this uncommon distinction with Céline's Les Beaux Draps, A Fine Mess, which was banned from print inside the Third Reich for being too hateful. This status of notoriety has served to propel Siege to new dimensions as a harangue bold enough to advocate sheer political terror. Indeed, Mason views the prevalent status quo establishment as enemy number one and has striven to foster its decolation by any means available. Much of the criticism Mason has attracted stems from his praise of Charles Manson as a misunderstood ideological leader. Superficial minds immediately dismissed this claim as preposterous, but Manson did not carve a swastika on his forehead without reason. Manson does consider himself a kind of neo-Nazi, and what is neo about his Nazism is at times quite fascinating. Thus, Mason deserves credit for taking Manson seriously enough to glimpse the very coherent meaning behind his apparent facade of madness. Furthermore, both Mason and Manson have nothing but contempt for right-wing shenanigans and escapist fantasies that purport to wage battle over pivotal issues that must not be lost, when in reality the greater war to even preemptively assert such causes has already been crushed. Suffice it to say, this open honesty has not endeared Mason with those of a lukewarm and elusive mentality. The writing done by James Mason for his Siege newsletter espouses, bar none, the most lucid ultimatum yet promulgated for soldiers of the cause, total attack, or total dropout from the system. Kind of reminds me of Joachim Cruyff's Total Football in the early 70s. He did the Cruyff turn and training all people to be aggressive, to fill all the different roles at the same time so they could all go and attack and immediately get the ball back and such. Anyway, that just occurred. Not coincidentally, this admission of brute force wherewith to attain eventual liberation stands as the critical textual thesis upon which this tome is founded. Total attack or total dropout, two options. Promulgated for soldiers of the cause, we read at the bottom of page 11. As Mason explains, society is deteriorated to the point where it is crass idiocy to imagine that anything can be salvaged or gradually reformed by following traditional avenues of electioneering or encoded law. Likewise, Siege also expounds on how it is nowadays absurd to contemplate full engagement against Zog by means of noble violence, as there is no longer the existing time, numbers, or expertise to wipe the slate clean in this manner. The pages of Siege bear testament to the many who have tried, quote, heightening the contradictions, unquote, through guerrilla warfare, that's a Marxist phrase, and lost, becoming purposeful martyrs, either imprisoned or killed outright. Maybe he means the Order. They were doing their stuff around the time he was writing his newsletter. Thus, only the second half of the equation remains a viable practicality, a total dropout, capital TDO, and withdrawal. With regard to those few elite who do extricate obedience to Zog by a sworn dropout and refuse to morally sanction or materially support a criminal government, yet who disavow warnings about the sensibleness of launching total attack, capital TA, offensives toward key institutions, industries, and political corporate media figureheads, Mason nonetheless extends wise counsel to such warriors imbued with enough elan to breach boundaries of no return. Counsel misspelled there, used the wrong one. In case anybody ever edits that. As Siege elaborates upon, if you are determined to unleash iron justice or to make a valiant sacrifice with your life, then do so with finesse and style. Moreover, select prudent targets that count! Aim for the most menacing and influential pigs, then dispatch them with methodical viciousness. Act alone or in small numbers. Remember, the soft underbelly of this whole monstrous setup is the volatile economy that fuels it. Siege also points out that elements of aesthetic terrorism are duly factors to be considered, as exemplified by the flamboyant immolation of statured Jews. race traders, and plastic glamour stars in California during the late summer of 1969. Such brazen killings and mass murder slayings in general precipitate shockwaves of paranoia that ignite massive confusion and stir discord. But sadly enough, many greater instances of organized resistance around the world have also miserably failed to rouse Aryans from stagnant slumber or begun to dislodge the dominion wielded by a shadowy parasite, which contravenes all indigenous blood destiny. The aftermath of vindication strikes against the very seat of Zog's tyrannical power. The Pentagon and World Trade Center seems eloquent empirical proof of this. In fact, things have reached such a decrepit stage that any American State of the Union sitting could be ironically be blown to hell, killing every last political whore, bureaucratic pig, and Shabbos goy in attendance, and the pathway toward imminent destruction of the West at the behest of the Jewish intrigue wouldn't be tremendously altered. A sheer expression of misplaced cynicism? Not really. The remnant white population is now so enslaved by debt, avarice, and ostensible affluence that most have unwittingly been rendered quite complacent in form and deed. Swarthy masters of international finance have adeptly positioned their god of mammon to ensure absolute damage control. However, minor consolation is obtained when realizing that this current epoch of dystopia is a natural process entirely structured in accord with cyclical history. This present Ragnarok / Apocalypse / Kali Yuga time frame is preordained, set to burst forth cataclysm that will advertently necessitate a healthful catharsis of all undesirable elements. From chaos comes rebirth and order. So before a world-redeeming baptism by fire erupts, how can one best preserve sanity and ensure true sovereignty of soul on a planet engulfed by iniquity, hypocrisy, and folly? Furthermore, where can this reconciling stratagem for survival be found? Much of the solution rests within the pages of the book you now hold. At this juncture, social malaise cannot be halted, only accelerated onward to the abyss, capitulating the whole vile episode of this end cycle. Savitri Devi's classic book, The Lightning and the Sun, outlines precisely this same terrible indictment, or terminal indictment, which shares unique similarity with Mason's total dropout stance. Both authors exhort those in the service of truth not to work for temporal arrest of Western putrefaction, but instead consciously strive to make it worse. All caps. As Siege details, the secret to fomenting implosion is to rout the system's own nefarious momentum against itself and reflect every bombardment of nihilism back to the instigative source to stoke frenzy and reap greater sabotage. In short, championing the system to overdose on its own virulent poison. Exclamation point. When this transpires en masse, Mason has repeatedly stressed that most will die along with the system. More poignant still, most already have expired, and represent the very antithesis of life, living cadavers. A fitting coup de grace and burial are long overdue. Previously dug graves beckon. What remains a preponderant complexity is just when optimal dirt shoveling occurs. James Mason was born in Chillicothe, Ohio on July 25, 1952. Family relations had lived in this region of the American heartland, spelling American with a K, for generations, Chillicothe, Ohio. His ancestral background is mainly composed of Norman with a drop or two of Irish and Dutch blood. Mason's parents were confident and patriotic citizens. His father was enlisted as a Navy serviceman stationed in the Pacific during World War II, and his mother was likewise a lieutenant in the Army Nurse Corps during the same period. Both later worked at a local veterans hospital. As a single child in a predominantly middle-class home during the 1950s, he lacked few comforts. However, as Mason further divulges, his parents did have distant suspicions something was errant. Quote, "My father was a casual atheist, and my mother a nominal Methodist. Both were Republicans. They were good people. They had the right values, although they were disturbed about what was beginning to happen in the country. But they were powerless to stop it because they didn't have the philosophical groundwork. That's what I had. I took all the beliefs they had, put them together, put a name and a symbol to it, and made a militant idea out of it. Good old American apple pie, but with teeth. From the earliest age, Mason harbored an intuitive resentment of authority, especially hollow authority, for its own sake. The public school curriculum that so flawlessly indoctrinates most minds into reflexive automatons was the epitome of sinister falsehood Mason found intolerable and repellent. From age 13 onward, a predilection for National Socialism irresistibly developed, and by the summer of 1966, the swastika's indelible allure asserted permanent reign. Not astonishingly, tensions began to escalate with school administrators who were determined to correct all rebelliousness and instill discipline. Mason thought otherwise and proceeded to stage outrageous infractions of school code to orchestrate expulsions. After attempting to provoke another lengthy expulsion in the fall of 1968 through failing grades, truancy, and conduct violations, the school shifted tactics and now staunchly refused to expel Mason under any circumstances whatsoever, as particular students were starting to emulate his antics. A chance encounter with a dramatic book entitled Extremism USA, which painted a lurid description of the active left versus right dichotomy, granted the postal address enabling him to become a bona fide youth division member of the American Nazi Party. There was a kid floating around, classified as a weirdo, who had gotten in touch with the American Nazi movement. During 1964, there was the Goldwater campaign, and all the kinds of extremist talk, and somebody cut loose with a book dealing with the far left and the far right. Extremism USA is the book. In the part about the far right, there was the ANP and a photo of Alan Vincent, the San Francisco Nazi leader, in a demonstration, and he had a pickup truck. Across the gate of the truck was his local address. So this kid wrote that address. Vincent referred him to Arlington headquarters in Virginia, and that was it. My interest was picking up independently, so I went to him to get the address. I practically grabbed him and said, I want this address because I want to join this outfit. But he wanted to propagandize me. He wanted to give me A&P literature. I said, I don't want this shit. I don't want to read this. I just want to join. That was in late 1966. Close quote. Meanwhile, the school predicament almost reached a violent apex. Right around December 1968, Mason formulated a novel approach to deal with combative and problematic teachers / system bureaucrats. Kill them. Quote, I just want it out. For the previous year, I would intentionally get myself expelled from school just to be out of there, but in the ensuing period of time, they got wise to me and they weren't going to let me out anymore. No matter what I did, smoke in the hallway, stage fights, etc., they weren't going to throw me out. So it was headed for confrontation. I was headed for boys' industrial school and was told this was a prison for boys. I wasn't going to let that happen, of course, so I made up my mind in 1968. My father had all kinds of weapons at home, and I was going to take a .44 Magnum, which was a 5-shot revolver, go into the staff office and take out the principal, assistant principal, and two of the guidance counselors, and then finally myself. It's funny, long before this, people started doing like that, he was thinking in those terms like 30 years too early. The slaughter was averted by the timely intervention of William Pierce, who gladly solicited assistance at American Nazi Party headquarters in Arlington when Mason conveyed how dire the situation had become. Later attributing his lust for carnage to the same factors of alienation that inspired Columbine and other school massacres, Mason claims the rotten system is alone responsible for the seething dosage of egalitarianism and multiracial socialism that breeds nihilist disaffection. The current establishment is the poison dispenser. When the insane policies of America encourage orgies of wanton murder and suicide, those tenets of belief require a merciless bullet to quell disaster. As Mason propounds, nothing happens in a vacuum. Everything is cumulative. Upon arrival at ANP headquarters, Mason accomplished regular duties with punctiliousness and soon was in charge of the party's antiquated printing press. The premise was anything but extravagant. Stormtrooper personnel resided in a ramshackle building 6 blocks away that was unheated with no hot water and constituted a primitive shelter at best. Mason slept on the floor next to the printing machine. Party members received a stipend amounting to a little more than $15 per week, which was a paltry sum even in the 1960s. Those comrades who didn't have recourse to outside households lived a tight, narrow existence for the struggle. Yet in spite of all these drawbacks, food was cheap in those days and the residency was virtually free, as rent was paid through loyal dedication and service to party objectives. Mason remained here, on and off, until the summer of 1970, participating in street demonstrations alongside covert attacks on leftist persons and property. In 1967, the American Nazi Party changed its name to the National Socialist White People's Party. Since George Lincoln Rockwell's assassination on August 25, 1967, the leadership triumvirate consisted of Matt Cale, William Pierce, and Robert Lloyd. An acrimonious dispute quickly grew between Pierce and Cale over crucial realpolitik decisions. According to Mason, Pierce insisted on modifying the image of National Socialism from that of uniforms and goose-stepping to a modern variant less foreign to American sensibility, whereas Cale favored a cult-like group that preserved doctrinaire traditions. After Mason chose to leave and return to Ohio to take over management of family affairs in the summer of 1970, increasing rancor precipitated shortly a crisis that witnessed a schism of party factions. Cale retained governance of the NSWPP and all real estate. Pierce splintered off and founded the National Youth Alliance, which is known contemporarily as the National Alliance. Reminiscing upon why the formal ANP crafted by Rockwell and its eventual successor, the NSWPP, attracted little support from relatively affluent conservatives and the general populace at large, Mason glumly comments, "We would tell ourselves, or try to make up reasons for why it wasn't going anywhere. Well, maybe things aren't bad enough." I think that was the big one. Things weren't bad enough. When they got bad enough, and if we had our message out there in front of enough people, when it got bad enough, they'd remember us, and they'd come running. Well, that was just a dream, because it's already gotten worse now than we ever thought it could become. And they're certainly not beating a path to our door. We were kidding ourselves there. Everything from, quote, "they were materialistic and didn't want to risk income and luxuries," to media brainwash and the distorted image we had. But these were all excuses and apologies. We never went at it seriously enough as a party with a social platform. When Mason again struck up Native Roots, agitation was anything but dormant. At the behest of a kindred soul, Mason was persuaded to jointly assault a few down-home Negroes. Encountering this slothful group one evening, Mason and his friend assailed them with canisters of mace and fists. For this premeditated crime, Mason was arrested for racial assault in 1973. As 1974 rolled around, he was subsequently tried and convicted. While incarcerated for 6 months at the ancient Cincinnati workhouse, which dated from the Civil War, the grim atmosphere of being locked up with undesirable, dysgenic fuck-ups afforded him the opportune chance to either quit or get serious. He chose the latter option and crystallized ideas for the basis of a new political front solely constructed to draw first blood from the system. About this same time, Joseph Tomasi, T-O-M-M-A-S-I, emerged as a pioneering leadership figure. Disgruntled with Cale's inadequacy, Tomasi initiated his own unique brand of American National Socialism that forever changed underground politicking in America. But before this intrepid revitalization occurred, he was still a loyal adherent to Cale's NSWPP. Cale, as it turns out, K-O-E-H-L, German name, he was in Wisconsin is where he took the NSWPP, where it would exist for many decades. Cale, as it turned out, was innately jealous of Tomasi's profound ability to organize more strength than even NSWPP headquarters could muster. To counteract this embarrassing disequilibrium, Cale infiltrated spies into Tomasi's Los Angeles command unit to ascertain the validity of alleged, quote, "loose morals." Perhaps such execrable vices as girls occasionally kept overnight or indulgences with marijuana were transpiring. In any case, Cale suspended Tomasi, terminating a potential rival. This prosperous estrangement enabled Tomasi to rely upon his own strict talents for organization. He termed his guerrilla movement the NSLF, National Socialist Liberation Front, and dropped all legalistic pretenses. Tomasi was so successful in terrorizing the communist, Negro, and Mestizo bloc coalitions that he forced them to scream for police protection. The effectiveness of Tomasi's action was due to his adamancy in refusing to entertain any more right-wing fantasies. Instead, Tomasi took an unparalleled step forward by assembling the wreckage of right-wing conventionalism into a formidable vehicle of armed instauration, as was later exemplified by the Bruderschweigen liberation struggle. By eschewing safe and insular campaigns for democratic reform through routes of artifice and intrigue, which terribly deplete resources and manpower with discouraging outcomes, Tomasi reversed tactics and chose political terror as an instrument to raise the stakes of battle. This terrorist provocation earned him instant acclaim, but also irascible denunciation and ostracism from shallow revolutionaries who found it unconscionable to transgress the system's firewall rule of fair play and thereby embrace a cold mandate beyond good evil that permits whatever is necessary. Beyond good slash evil that permits whatever is necessary. Tomasi developed a slick propaganda campaign that maximized awareness of the true oppressive monster, the United States government. NSLF flyers and pamphlets featured depictions of bombed-out bank buildings, arsons, assassination targets, and incisive sloganeering such as, "The future belongs to the few of us still willing to get their hands dirty. Political terror." End quote. And, quote, "Cops are political soldiers. Political terror, it's the only thing they understand." At long last, a cabal of National Socialists had caught up to their leftist nemesis. You remember the Weather Underground, etc., were bombing people around this time, or had been a few years earlier. But within the decade of his starting this, or taking up this approach. But Tomasi didn't stop there. Recognizing the imperativeness of blending into your surroundings inconspicuously, he and fellow comrades drastically altered their appearances to fit the liberal counterculture. No more spit-shined boots, dress regulations, or haircut requirements. Dingy and cliché clothing attire was worn, and hair grown long. The overall impersonation was that of unkempt, harmless hippies. All these determinants forged the NSLF into the preeminent spotlight. For, as Tomasi opined, it is well to be loved or hated, but when you're in a situation where no one gives a damn, that's political death. Mason had several occasions for dialogue with Tomasi in person. The first such incident fell on the NSWPP First Congress rally held Labor Day 1969. A close rapport established itself, and both men maintained regular correspondence thereafter. Again, pre-internet, long pre-internet. In fact, the Internet was founded in 1969 by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, part of the DOD, but obviously not available to the public. Mason was fascinated by Tomasi's charisma and the intense revolutionary zealousness that punctuated his character. Much of NSLF's raucous stylization was hijacked by Mason's next venture, the NSM, National Socialist Movement. When Mason gained release from the confines of prison in 1975, Tomasi would soon be dead, his assassination engineered by NSWPP members, ironically past compatriots, in August 1975. Roused to resume where Tomasi abruptly left off, Mason's ambitious plan was to facilitate a kind of propaganda experiment and kindle a conglomerate federation between heretofore uncooperative National Socialist and KKK leadership pools, while subtly injecting this pan-Aryan echelon with profuse NSM militancy. The NSM's aggressive ideological proclivities ranged from engendering outright overthrow, a la Tomasi, to a gentler mass strategy approach. NSM literature was a rape upon cerebral conformity. Mason accentuated his ulterior motive of, quote, extinguishing the house fire by the open adulation of all illegality that threatened system survival. This tour de force of exercised anarchism was slated to counterpunch the federal government into a vegetative state of paralysis, or at least chip away at the abstract facade of so-called inalienable democratic freedoms. Mason dared to fathom the Prussian issue at large. Why not aspire to help put the system in an impossible snare through aiding the erosion of its own laws and bylaws that masquerade as constitutional liberties? Tomasi always emphasized, heighten the contradictions. One of the chief NSM leaflets in this context displayed a photograph of paramount anti-establishment boogeyman Charles Manson. Superimposed underneath was a statement of Shaw to the Fabian socialist movement in Britain. Quote, whilst we, the conventional, were wasting our time on education, agitation, and organization, some independent genius has taken the matter in hand. Again, that under a picture of Charles Manson. Shocking enough, Shaw was actually lauding Jack the Ripper. Other transgressive leaflets saluted, quote, heroes of the revolution, and particularly championed Lynette Squeaky Fromm for her courageous assassination attempt on President Ford's life on September 5, 1975. Such incendiary posturing sent reverberant shockwaves across the movement, separating the wheat from the chaff. But Mason quickly discovered even the grandest schemes have limited horizon without consequential finances. In 1976, Mason resigned membership from Cale's NSWPP out of bitter disgust for incompetence and lack of tangible progress. While Mason was accountable for almost every written composition and artistry of the NSM, a sympathetic right-winger provided the backing funds. The gentleman was eager to legitimize the NSM, streamlining it into yet another P.O. Box fan club, rife with official membership cards and monthly dues. Mason thought this contemptible and a recipe for failure. Truthfully, Mason never contrived the NSM as anything beyond an intermediate organ to dispel reactionary propaganda. Growing angst reached its zenith with his associates' difficult egocentrisms and foolhardiness, so Mason decided to abandon the whole enterprise. Following his departure, the NSM slowly withered and then dissipated entirely, temporarily derailed, but with goals still steadfast in the foreground. Mason ingratiated his skill with Alan Vincent's National Socialist White Workers Party in California, and from 1978 until 1980, he drafted much of the promotional material. Past affiliates of Tomasi had been pondering the feasibility of resuscitating the now-defunct NSLF. Trusted friends Alan Vincent, Carl Hand, John Duffy, Ed Reynolds, and of course Mason were the winning combination behind this impetus. Fate didn't stop carving Mason's volatile destiny here, though. While engaged with the propaganda scope of NSM in Cincinnati, Mason was casually informed by a close acquaintance one day that both Manson women, Sandra Good and Squeaky Fromm, were interned at the same women's correctional facility of Alderson, West Virginia. In a rash, spur-of-the-moment mindset, he mailed off a letter. Expecting no reply, he was slightly amazed when a guarded missive came back. As later revealed, so many kooks and hypocrites had approached the Manson girls that they were natural skeptics as to Mason's sincerity. Suffice it to say, Mason was enraptured and began a studious examination of the Manson family. What he ultimately disinterred amounted to a sizable divergence from the system's generated image. The girls encouraged Mason to make formal contact with Manson and forwarded his letters as an introduction. When a meeting of minds did transpire, Mason became a convinced Manson enthusiast and a proponent. Mason still fondly recalls the first collect call Manson placed. Upon accepting the toll fees, the first words Manson spoke were, "Boy, it sure sounds like Ohio." Unfortunately, Providence never granted Mason a personal encounter with the Son of Man. In May of 1984, Mason had bought plane tickets and a visitation was scheduled. Manson became irate at not being able to secure a private conference room and refused to consent to anything less so Mason ashamedly had to cancel his pilgrimage. Mason met impregnable distress in unveiling Manson as an instructive visionary to fellow National Socialists. Quote, "These people are really mindless. I ran into that to an extreme degree when I associated myself with Charles Manson. Oh my God, look at the man's hair, look at his clothes, he's immoral. We can't have that, we represent law and order, middle class America. I've repeatedly stated that Charlie is the greatest National Socialist alive today. Well, is he a member of any of our groups? That's like saying if Jesus Christ were to return to Earth, with his beard, robe, and sandals, one of these stupid Christian assholes telling him there's a dress code before admittance to the church." Friction and clashes ensued in the NSLF directive over the Manson portrayal. Carl Hahn couldn't overcome the media stereotype of the Manson element, and Mason chose to part ways with as little internecine warfare as possible. The agreement reached stipulated that Mason would keep the Siege newsletter going strong, whereas Hahn would continue the NSLF pursuit. Manson and Mason kept their amiable relationship, and together they crafted the new beginnings of Universal Order, capital UO. By the early 1980s, Mason was once more absolved of joint collaboration, as Universal Order's voice and reason was answerable only to his inward drives. Manson suggested the dominant emblem that would henceforth be connected to Universal Order, a clockwise swastika, later reversed, stationed over the scales of justice. From 1980 to 1986, the monthly installment of Siege was published with dependable sureness. The language underwent a noticeable metamorphosis from what NSLF extrapolated. Mason still hailed serial killers, mass murderers, and eccentric commandos of all stripes, but now invested his literature with aspects of stoic self-preservation. A chapter from Mein Kampf proclaims, "The strongest man stands alone." Mason comparatively theorized that if one could make provisions to subsist outside the group of system servitude, outside the grasp of system servitude, you've in essence become a crude weapon. In Mason's view, Manson was a symbol par excellence of this alternative survival complex, that is, total dropping out. As Mason surmises, there's not enough Jews to run this circus show called the United States government. There has to be massive white sellouts. A good example is that, of all those eligible to vote, less than half do. That's pretty telling. They're tired. They get the idea the whole thing is a shell game, that it's heads they win, tails you lose. They're apathetic. However, it hasn't been carried all the way because they still work their 40-hour-a-week jobs, pay the taxes, and obey laws. I guess they just pay lip service to the system, hoping things will someday improve. You may still have segments within the movement that will be so idiotic as to say, "Write your congressman," or "Go support so-and-so's grassroots campaign." They're not in touch with reality. What they're doing is, I compare this to Bram Stoker's, the guy who wrote Dracula, allegory about the Jews, giving their life to the dead vampire. The vampire couldn't survive without their blood. If these people could ever say this is garbage, all fake, all smoke and mirrors, and not participate, it wouldn't take that much to bring this affair crumbling down. But they're drones. Zombies. Manson once asserted, quote, "When the television finally goes off, half will go immediately insane. The other half will just sit there waiting for the television to come back on." Nevertheless, Mason prophesizes that if the sickness of Western civilization goes out with a bang instead of a whimper at the 12th hour, the celebratory exultation and lion's share of spoils will be devoured amongst those elite who compassionately slit the first throats. Mason wrapped up the Siege reports by 1986. He postulated that enough Universal Order ideas had sufficiently permeated underground spheres to have an independent life of their own. Surprisingly, media coverage and exposés remained silent until Red Worthen, who was a legitimate Universal Order affiliate, executed a system informant, which generated brief publicity and spontaneous outcry. Regional California pulp headlines questioned whether Manson was a new Hitler. With lenient time available, Mason designed in 1987 several high-octane promotional pamphlets. One bore the inscription, Drugs, Power, and Sanity. The beauty and friendship evolved, culminating in the aspirin offer to collect all Siege newsletters into a final volume. This first edition heralded magnificent sensation, reaching an eclectic audience hungry for cathartic bloodletting. Universal Order had gleaned the reputation as a dangerous provocateur. Mason's FBI dossier was now thousands of pages in breadth and enjoyed the premium classification of a probable presidential assassinate. Nonetheless, phone taps and surveillance didn't detour his revolutionary outgrowth. When a refinance of assets in 1991 necessitated a swift departure from his hometown of Chillicothe, Ohio, he chose to settle in a sleepy backwater town in southern Colorado. Soon thereafter, domestic squabbles sowed a climactic denouement with a firearm. A young paramour Mason was intimately involved with in 1993 betrayed her charms. Or her chums, I'm not sure which. Mason reciprocated this uncouth chastity by leveling the score with whoredom and brandished a firearm. This vengefulness led to criminal arrest. Out on bail with court proceedings pending, Mason packed his belongings and traveled to Denver. During this hiatus, Mason struck up familiarity with hierarchical representatives of the Church of Satan. Mason had always reserved a gratuitous appreciation for Anton LaVey and proudly owned the vintage 1968 LP recording of the Satanic Black Mass. LaVey also gifted Mason a personally inscribed copy of his Infernal Satanic Bible. Lex Talionis was a perspicuous concept Mason richly adhered to and found compelling. Quote, LaVey had a great many similarities to George Lincoln Rockwell. They were both showmen. Rockwell's father was a vaudevillian. LaVey had been a carnival man. LaVey had concluded that if God is portrayed by the Christian church, the way it exists, represents weakness and even suicide, then it stands to reason that his opposite adversary, Satan, has got to be worth a second reappraisal. Satan must represent strength and vitality in a Promethean sense. So on the basis of that, LaVey formed his Church of Satan. I thought that was absolutely brilliant. Mason was interviewed twice on air by a Denver radio evangelist for profit, Bob Larson. The first 1991 episode was an extravaganza called Manson Maniacs. Mason's performance was, at the finest acuity, and peaked when Doris Tates, the mother of R.I.P. Sharon Tate, lethargic, chemically sopped brain was dealt a blistering verbal barrage of potent truth, making short shrift of her rambling incoherence. Mason ended the program bombastically declaring, if you want to fight evil, you'd better fight against the U.S. government, because they allow it, they protect it, they subsidize it, they are it, the most evil thing that's ever existed. Close quote. Bob Larson proposed another jousting session in the summer of 1993, 2 years later. Surrounded by three hulking bodyguards in Larson's studio for the taping of neo-Nazi Satanism, Mason's raison d'etre would trample roughshod over Larson's odd theology of vain, sententious benevolence, hilariously slaughtering this obnoxious lamb of the Lord. Despite all resistance to the contrary, the gnashing clutch of prison loomed. In 1995, the punitive system rendered a guilty verdict of felony menacing with a deadly weapon and ordered 3 years in rehabilitative custody. Sequestered as a thought criminal in maximum security, the extent of Mason's proportional internment was at Colorado State Penitentiary. From the outset, Mason stirred hostile sentiments among crazed Negroes and mestizos run afoul of the law. Quote, I'd ask, what are you in here for? Oh, we shot it out with the West Side. Shooting it out with the West Side? You and the West Side should get together and go shoot it out with the police. Invade City Hall, kill all of them. Those are your enemies. Muslim Negroes thanked him for educating them about the Jewish question, exclaiming, now we know where to direct our anger. While being transferred from Pueblo County Jail to state prison, mestizos even lined up to shake hands in farewell solidarity. Confinement ensconced his writing talent. and he penned copious articles, letters, and book material. One peculiar work, entitled The Theocrat, shatters Christian orthodoxy. Juxtaposing Christ and Hitler as one, The Theocrat draws valid synchronism between Mein Kampf and biblical scriptures. Mason claims many of the questions and principles posited by Hitler in his magnum opus can be illuminated by reading the pronouncements of Jesus in the Gospels, and vice versa. Is this dreaded Christian identity? No. Only the genuine exposition of a perennial blood mythos that recurs under different guises throughout history. Mason was released from detainment on August 25, 1999, the anniversary of George Lincoln Rockwell's 1967 assassination. The millennium has seen James Mason more resolute than ever. Portending a Heraclitean conflagration that happily incinerates human dross, he cheers all violence, political, social, economic, that drags the system's inertia downward. For truly, when all is atrophied and scattered in ruination, what more is there to compromise or lose? The future awaits the sociopathic Übermensch. Siege is to be used as a cookbook and a guide. It is sincerely hoped this edition will prevail upon the vigilante intelligence to. It is sincerely hoped this edition will prevail upon the vigilant intelligence to heed a clarion call, wage battles of attrition, and act in a manner commensurate to Timothy McVeigh's of Oklahoma City fame. And that was by Ryan Schuster, spring of 2003. And that will conclude what we're doing today up through page 28, actually. Or no, I'm sorry, there's one more little bit. 1.3, Publisher's Note to the Readership on page 29. James Mason and I have conspired to enlarge and improve this second edition of Siege to the fullest extent. In this respect, many inclusions are strictly unique to this book. While the mainstay textual content remains little altered from the original presentation, major noteworthy additions can be found in the appendix of Death Throes that exhibits material in relation to Joseph Tomasi, Lone Wolf / Live Wire escapades, and the nature of revolutionary National Socialist politics in general. For the sake of convenience and clarity, I have endeavored to observe the same guidance of topic structure that aligns broad chapter headings with correspondent editorials marked by a bracketed date and volume/issue number from the Siege newsletters of derivation. This manner of regimentation provides most agreeable for establishing fluid cohesiveness. So it's kind of topically arranged, drawn from the magazine itself. And so this is the background, personally, of the man who wrote the newsletters of which the Siege is composed. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon with more of Siege.